This podcast is produced by the Center for Deployment Psychology at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. In addition, references to any specific companies, products, processes, or services does not necessarily constitute or imply endorsement by the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. Welcome to CDP's podcast, Practical for Your Practice,
where we give you actionable intel to support what you do, one colleague to another.
Welcome or welcome back to Practical for Your Practice. I am Jenna Ermold, today with Kevin Holloway as co-host.
Hey, Jenna.
How are you, Kevin?
I'm hanging in there. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, and I'm doing well because I am really stoked to chat with today's guest.
Yes, me
and
too.
That is what is keeping me feeling energized, because I'm going to tell you, this guest has a lot of energy, and
yes,
I need that right now. And I'm going to jump right in because we got a lot to talk about today.
Yeah.
So, you know, we created this podcast. It's intended to be this sort of community and resource for all of you out there, all you wonderful providers who are in the real world implementing EBPs. Those manualized treatments that are kind of a specific intervention that targets a specific mechanism, and they're awesome, and we love them, and they're the cornerstone to how many of our clients, you know, kind of recover through that.
Right.
But Kevin, it gets complicated, right? Because how many clients do we see are sort of straightforward versus very complex? So how engage in evidence-based practice when there's this like really complex case? What do we do when that clinical picture is like less than straightforward? So somebody has PTSD and psychosis, for example. Well, I have good news for you today.
What's that?
To talk about this topic, we have the absolutely fabulous, highly energized Dr. Aaron Brennan.
Oh, awesome.
We were so lucky to have at our evidence-based psychotherapy conference last year, where he delivered a fabulous talk. So, Dr. Aaron Brennan, welcome to Practical for Your Practice podcast.
Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited that I was finally able to join you guys, right?
Yeah.
This has been a long time coming.
We've been working on this for a while.
Yeah. It has been, right. You know,
I have the email thread to prove it.
I know. Good things come to those who wait.
That's true.
Right.
That's true. We're here now. Can you just give a little snapshot of who you are and your background to include this work that you do? And why did you get interested in this area?
Yeah. So my name is Dr. Aaron Brennan. I'm a clinical psychologist. And I started a long time ago, all the way through my master's, all the way through my doctorate. All I did was study how to treat post-traumatic stress disorder. Along the way, I read all these books and I found my way to the Center for Treatment Study of Anxiety at the University of Pennsylvania, where I did a practicum under Elizabeth Hembry, where I learned prolonged exposure. And I started to learn this idea of, it's not what you're doing, it's why are you doing it? And so it wasn't that PE is, I do my imaginal exposure, I do my rationale, right? Like in all of those, but what are you trying to accomplish in that moment? And as I started to do this, this idea of why am I doing, what I'm doing started to formulate in my brain. And I always had that idea of this strategy for change. And I also recognized as I was doing my dissertation, which is really about motivation, right? So I applied motivational interviewing to prolonged exposure, because motivational interviewing being trying to resolve somebody's ambivalence toward engaging in behavior change, and avoidance is a behavior.
Right.
And so I applied it toward avoidance in PTSD and really just looking at a very basic piece of it. And so as I'm looking at all these cases, I recognized there are no simple PTSD cases.
Right.
Right. You know, I was looking at all of these videos of cases from the original study where they looked at prolonged exposure compared to prolonged exposure where they added cognitive restructuring. right? And I didn't see, there were like no simple cases, right? And then I was seeing cases and I was like, I don't know where this like mystical, like unicorn simple case is, but they don't show up to my offices. And so I start this process of thinking about how do all of these parts work together? And then I was able to go and I was able to do my internship at the Coatesville VA, where I got to serve individuals. They were always so kind to me. You know, the Vietnam veterans were fantastic, right? Because I was like this really silly puppy dog, right? The drill sergeants loved me. I don't know that they loved me, but they found me pathetic, but they like humored me. The GWAT guys, you know, they would sort of make fun of me, but they all started calling me Doc. So I must've been doing something okay.
That's when you know you're in. When you
right, right? Title. Yeah, yes, yeah. And 100%.
And for our listeners, GWAT stands for the Global War on Terrorism, which started after 9/11.
And so then I finished my postdoc, and I had to go do a postdoc after my doctorate. And I went to the University of Pennsylvania, where I started working with Aaron Beck. And they needed somebody to, I started working on his work with schizophrenia. And I always applied this idea of what are the levers that we're pulling, right? Because I've done throughout my career, these manualized treatments, right? Whether it's prolonged exposure with response prevention, motivational interviewing, mm-hmm. right? Social anxiety disorder treatment, right? I can kind of list all of them. But my thought was always about what are the levers that you're pulling? So while I was working with Tim Beck, we're starting to develop this treatment for individuals with negative symptoms, the ones least likely to engage in psychosocial treatments. Mm-hmm. And that was the work that really has sort of driven the rest of my career. But I still wanted to serve individuals. And so, well, on one hand, I still serve individuals today.
Yeah.
And I still get to do a lot more PTSD treatment today than I've ever done in my career, which I love. I still serve individuals with psychosis. I get to do all of this work together. I train people. I've always been more focused in on what are the levers we're pulling when we're doing these interventions. And when I start whatever treatment I'm starting, I pull out my PE checklist. I pull out my EXRP checklist. I do the worry intervention the way it's written, but I'm focused on what am I trying to pull? And right. So that's sort of this journey that I've gone on.
I love that so much because I think, and Jenna, certainly tell me if I'm wrong here, but so Jenna and I are both.
Kevin, don't worry. I don't tend to hold back there. So
Jenna and I are both PE trainers too and consultants, right? And so, and we get the question constantly in all of these workshops, like, but you know, this textbook perfect client you keep talking about here and how you do the therapy with this textbook perfect client, they don't exist. Like there's all sorts of other things going on. So would it be okay if I mix a bit of this and mix a bit of that and whatever, how do we deal with that complexity? And I just, you know, I think that's been my experience too. I've never met a simple, straightforward, they have just one problem, but everything else is hunky-dory kind of client.
So I do want to acknowledge they do exist.
Okay.
And I've seen cases where the PTSD has not metastasized. I use the phrase, yeah. PTSD has not metastasized,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
They have PTSD. It's legitimate PTSD. It has not gotten into all of the parts of their lives. The mm-hmm. individuals that we supervise, the individuals that we sort of assist in serving these other individuals, they're probably not seeing those folks, right? Those folks don't usually show up at a psychologist's office, right? They're usually seen by somebody else. But yeah, it might be like, it might be a person who had like a car accident, or honestly, it might be somebody who had a really bad trauma, right? And developed pretty severe symptoms. And they're seeing you at month 1.5. By the time you schedule them, it's month 1.5 and an extra week. And then by the time you have finished all the intake paperwork, it's 2 months and you could start PE. And those people, I'm doing my intake paperwork, you know, here, and I go, hey, is there anything else? And I kind of quickly tick down like all the DSM, and they're like, no, man, it's just these memories are haunting me. And I'm like, okay, cool. So for many people following a traumatic event, right? And I'm literally into the PE session one,
right?
Because five minutes in, I've got all the stuff that I need. And I'm like, I do it.
Sure.
But yeah, those are very unicorn cases. But most of the people who were seen in the studies of these very treatments,
right,
were not exactly simple cases.
Right.
And
right.
I think that is such a point we try to foot stomp. I think it comes from a good place. A lot of providers are like, yeah, but my client's special. My client's more complicated. My client comes with this. And we go back to the studies and say, you should see these, the populations mm-hmm. that these participants were drawn from are very similar to what's in your office. So,
and not in a snotty way. We're not like, no, your client's not so special. It's right. more like, hey, this is actually pretty common.
Yeah. And this is good news, because what I can tell you is, even though that's the case, we have great data to support that this can be really effective.
But, and I want to validate that feeling, yeah. right? For a couple mm-hmm. reasons. I think I've had that experience myself, even though I'm a trainer in a treatment that I developed, and I train people in PE, and I train people in a really effective treatment in persecutory delusions. And I've seen some of the people who I really respect in trainings and have that happen to them. I think it's a really natural experience of a therapist to go, yeah, but my case is different.
Yeah.
And so I think it comes from a place of PTSD and mental illness feels so insurmountable to us. And there's at times we can feel so small in its shadow that the idea that science can fight it off, and we want so desperately to help these people, we just feel like, how could this stupid science help?
Yeah,
I think it's natural. One of my dear friends who came and has been trained, and we consulted on this treatment of recovery-oriented cognitive therapy that I had developed. And she believed in it, and she helped other people in state hospitals do it. And she finally got me to come out to Utah to train all of these people. And oftentimes when I do trainings, I'll go out and we'll go and demonstrate with like a case or two. I'll go and meet with people in a hospital or something like that. And it's really a wonderful experience. And we go out to dinner afterwards. We're sitting there and eating dinner. And all of a sudden she leans in and she goes, you know, Aaron, I have to apologize. I go, what? What happened? I really had that experience when I watched you do it with my patient, where I went, okay, fine. I really did see it. I wanted to see it with my patient. I saw all the videos of you with other people, real patients real individuals in the real world. I wanted to see you do it with my individual.
That's great.
And so I do, like, when people say like, yeah, my individual is different, I get it. I get where Absolutely. We come from. And I think there's a whole host of reasons why we have that experience. And I think it comes from a place of, we want these individuals to be okay so badly, and we want to care for them so badly. And I think it comes from a place of caring.
And I think it's a strength. I mean, I think the way we can, and this is going to kind of take us to the next place I'd like to go. But if all of our clients were cookie cutter,
right,
you know, and we didn't take the time to really understand what is, you know, what are all the influences and factors that are keeping this person stuck in different ways than somebody else I'm working with? And that is actually what makes you a better EBP therapist.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Really, you know, addressing those nuances. And I know in your presentation, I really loved your analogy, metaphor, I get those mixed up, of the Rube Goldberg machine. So this idea that people are kind of in this little machine, you know, they go up, they go down, they go around, and they're stuck. Yeah. Really taking the time to understand how things work together, again, to kind of keep that client stuck in time. It's where you really kind of talked about the important, aspects of formulation and strategy for change. And so I really want to kind of go there. So we've got these complex these clients with complex presentations, and we want to use EBP. So like, how do those things fit in? What's important for providers to understand about formulation and then strategy for change when they're working with these complex clients?
Yeah. So I think one of the things we so frequently Or I so frequently see in supervision and consultation is providers or supervisees, their first words, their first discussion is about what am I going to do to the person or do with the person? And they're not thinking about why am I going to do with the person? Like what's going on? What needs to change? And I'm recovery oriented, so I know that can sound very top down. And we need to understand what is the physiology underneath of the mental distress that the person's experiencing. And so then collaboratively, we can decide how are we going to address it, right? And so the physiology is this perpetual motion machine that is driving the psychopathology. And psychopathology does not isolate itself, right? So PTSD doesn't hang out over here, and then psychosis hang out over here, and then social anxiety disorder hang over here, and then alcoholism hangs out over here, right?
They all
work together, right? They all interact together in this perpetual motion machine,
right?
And in this additive effect. The first time I recognized that was when I was on the inpatient combat PTSD unit, and I was asked to run a alcohol use disorders group, right? And I just sort of made it up. And one of the things I started to recognize is the alcohol use made the PTSD go off. And I started to try to figure out why that was, right? And I know that everybody on here is like going, yeah, no duh. We'll also remind everybody here that it was 16 years ago or 14, like, I don't even know how many years ago. Like, it was a bunch of years ago. And I was like, I was new at the rodeo gang. So
profound.
We're all going to be compassionate right now, right?
Of course, please. Of course.
And it didn't shock me, but I also wanted to figure out why. But I also wanted to figure out a way why that I could explain it to the veterans that I was serving. And so I realized that thought suppression requires the prefrontal cortex, right? And thought suppression is what sort of avoidance of memory is doing. But alcohol gets rid of your prefrontal cortex, right? And so once I could explain that the alcohol was stopping your prefrontal cortex from working, so the memories just got to kind of run in, I basically made this PowerPoint presentation about like all these little guards. And then the guards went and got drunk. And then the memories just started coming in. And they were like, oh, I get it now. And they're like,
right.
And so, but it's the idea that all of these problems work together. So if we talk about psychosis, if we talk about that. So we need the formulation first. And I think what happens, and I know this from, I train and supervise psychiatry residents, psychology interns. We're so fast to, I need to start working and doing stuff with people, we don't take time to figure out why are we going to do what we're going to do. Individuals, when we can start lining out what are the things that are going on sort of a big dry erase board or a yellow pad or the shared screen, if you're doing telehealth, right? Whatever your medium is, from super low tech, legal yellow pad to super high tech, you know, the telehealth, you know, shared screens, starting to draw up on there, what are the things that are going on, putting them up there, and then doing your good, whatever you call it. You might call it a functional analysis. I call it a chain analysis. DBT people call it a missing links analysis. Who cares? What you want to do is figure out what is driving it, right?
Yeah. With the client.
Huh?
With the client,
yeah.
Too.
Nobody knows better why you're drinking than the client. Nobody knows better what the experience is and how you're pushing the memory out of your mind and PTSD than the individual themselves. They know their tricks.
And I imagine that for clients, this can be really insightful, right? And illuminating, because in their minds, at least many of the folks that I've worked with, it does feel like there's so much going on. Most of it maybe isn't unrelated in their minds, and they feel like they're just so broken and crazy.
Yeah.
And it's like, how do we even start dealing with this. There's just so much going on. Sure, we can work on this one thing, but I still have all this other crap going on. And to have a discussion that really lays out like, no, this stuff's connected. This stuff relates to one another. Here's how they influence one another and why this might be showing up in your life the way that it is and how it might make sense, how it's not broken. It makes sense.
Right.
Well, and I think the reason why I said with the client, then I'll turn it back to you, obviously, Dr. Brennan, but we have supervised folks as well. I feel like there's this notion that case formulation is something we do. Like we figure it out and we overhear mm-hmm. As the people with the advanced degrees, you know, kind of put it all together. And we're missing, if we do not partner with our clients and I think, again, make mistakes like, hey, I see it fitting together like this. How do you see it? Oh, you see it really differently? Well, let's take that information into it too. So just sort of be vulnerable with the client to get the best case formulation by involving them. And you don't have to necessarily be, you know, you're expert on some things, but not expert on all things.
So here's my question. If you were a veteran, an active duty person, a spouse of an active duty person or a veteran, and you had gone through the system and maybe you didn't have the best rodeo ride through the system, and you sat with somebody and they kind of laid it out the way you're talking about. And they said, did I get it right? And then they were like, well, it's really more like this. And then you go, oh, and then they sort of adjusted it. What would that be like for you, right? What would that experience be like for you as you're sitting down thinking about doing this horrible idea of revisiting the memories, right? Like, Right. Absolutely. I've never had somebody be like, that sounds like fun. But what would that be like for you from a curative standpoint, having somebody go, oh man, I really didn't hear that right. You're right. That makes much more sense. And then they like cross it out or like erase it on the board right. Or like stuff like that. What would that be like for you, Jenna?
It would be empowering. It would make me feel like a, you know, an equal partner, or that I actually I wasn't helpless and hopeless, and I had something to contribute and I could help, you know, sort of shape where we were going.
And so then the next question I've got for you is for Kevin. So if you kind of like, I get your question about sort of like how it's insightful and those pieces, what would it be like for you? You've gone through it and maybe you're still active service and nothing's going right. You know, you try to do your lineup and you're standing next to everybody and your skin's crawling. You do it fine. You never get written up, but man, do you have to go to the bathroom just to sort of stop from shaking at the end of lineup, or you go to the VA and I mean, it's literally like the world is in opposite world. And you try to go to your kid's birthday party and no matter what happens, you know, you just can't stand there and none of the world makes sense. And then some, you know, silly looking psychologist and you sit down and together you kind of construct this thing on the board. And for the first time, it makes sense that as much as you've tried to not think about that memory, it keeps popping back in, right? And as much as you as much as you try not to go to the birthday party, it never makes it easier. What would that be like for you? Not just going, oh wow, that's the pattern, but like, what would that be like for you?
I think, you know, for me, that would be like, it's this epiphany of like, okay, now we've got something we can do about this.
Yeah.
Like if I can sit there with my therapist and figure out what's driving this stuff, then it makes more sense why a therapist might suggest certain interventions or perhaps even my motivation to engage in them, because now it feels like we're going somewhere and there's reasons why.
Yeah. And so I think pulling together, I think a lot of times when we think about, I think as Jenna said, this conceptualization is this sort of like esoteric academic waste. I think as an intervention for hope, for helping somebody not feel crazy, for helping somebody feel heard, you know, many of these individuals, the family is like, just pull it together, right? And they're sick of hearing about their stuff, whether it's that they fear that other people are trying to harm them, whether the memories are popping in their mind. How many of them have been told, hey man, just stop thinking about the memory, right? Or just stop drinking, right? But to be able to bring that together, see it on a board, and work together, that conceptualization starts by making them feel less crazy, feel like an equal in the process. And then together we could go, where do we want to go next? And that's Jenna's point of saying we could do this collaboratively.
And I think too, I mean, even you were just talking about kind of that sense that, you know, family members, friends are saying, just don't think about it. It's kind of this quick, you know, brush off, right? Like, hey, we're tired of hearing about it. We know you've got problems, just deal with it. I wonder if clients, and I think so, but I wonder if clients sometimes have that same experience when they're with a therapist who's like, oh yeah, trauma, let's do PTSD work, let's do PE, rather than spending this time to be heard. Like the, like the therapist gets them. Cause I imagine, and I've certainly even had clients tell me this, like, hey, well, you know, you said PTSD and we want to do PE, but there's other things going on that you haven't heard about. And that's kind of been like a stop for me. Like, you know what? Yeah, let's pull this back a little bit. What haven't I heard about? Let's talk about that. Yeah.
And here's the interesting dialectic here, right? So like, this is the really interesting thing. I think on one hand, we can create this perpetual motion machine so we can think about it together. And I think we can pull it together. I actually think that the more we lean into that, the faster we get to doing PE. Uh-huh. And it's not because I'm like, you know, I don't have like a you know, I don't have like a timer at the, at, you know, going like, you've got 15 sessions and you're, I don't, I mean, I know other places do, but it's such an interesting thing where I've done this and people are like, yeah, man, cool. So next session we're starting PE. Right. And so, it's sort of like those sort of finger traps, right? Like the harder I pull into the PE, the more people are like, like the leaning in and giving somebody that experience of being heard, doing that part of it. And it being a genuine experience, I really want to hear this, how this distress is being pulled together. And then we lean into, where do we want to go? Right. So one of the things I've seen in this idea of this, there's this idea that, well, I can't do any of this work until I have this really great rapport. One of the many millions of gigs that I end up having is as both a supervisor and a fidelity monitor. And I've been a supervisor and fidelity monitor on PTSD studies and on severe paranoia studies. Two groups of people who probably don't have rapport naturally, right? And it's such an interesting thing because when you're in a clinical trial, there's no kumbaya time. I mean, like you have a good rapport with people, but there's like, hi, my name's Aaron. I'm recording you right here. So, and then you're right into it. It's amazing how much rapport you can build up and you have zero flexibility. But people with really severe PTSD and really severe paranoia, persecutory delusions, six sessions, 10 sessions, and they get better. And so really flying in the face of like, it has to be this, we need this time for it.
So, you know, circling back to Jenna's kind of initial question at the beginning, you know, we've got a lot of evidence-based psychotherapies that are, you know, developed with a specific diagnosis in mind, with a specific set of problems in mind, and with a specific way to approach them. Certainly, you know, open for the therapist's style and their personality, but, you know, they tend to be very focused. One of the questions we get a lot in workshops is just like, well, then, you know, what do I do when I've got complex patients? Maybe this therapy isn't a good fit, or, hey, I need to kind of do the eclectic thing, like take a piece from PE and take a piece from psychodynamic and take a piece from whatever. And we'll just make this amalgam of therapies of EBPs that in their minds fits this very unique complex client, but it's never been tested before.
Right.
Like what do we do?
Right. Yeah. And I think that's the problem is, and not to sound unkind, nobody's ever run a randomized clinical trial on, you know, your intuition.
Right.
And so I think leaning into the fact that these individuals who were a part of these clinical trials, and also these individuals who are now being studied in, you know, across all of the EBP rollouts in the VA, you know, the research coming out that like for the Center for PTSD Studies and things like that, right? None of these cases are simple cases, right?
Right.
And we're seeing that these treatments work really, really well. They'd work much better if people did them instead of like 8.3% of people doing them, right?
Right.
That would be neat. not trying to be particularly grouchy, but having the formulation, agreeing what we're going to work on, and working on one piece and going forward. And so ultimately, this is really getting back at Jenna's point about collaboration, because I think she just, I think her putting forward that idea was so valuable, of saying, hey, so it looks like this memory is haunting you. There's a couple of ways that we can go about it, right? One of the ways that these memories continue to haunt us is that there are these stuck points that we can get into, right? And then, you know, the way that we think influences the way we feel and what we do. And so if we can figure out how to undo these stuck points, we think that the memory might stop haunting you as much, right? For other people, the more you avoid, you know, we know as many times as you avoid the memory, it makes it, you know, it never makes it easier to stop avoiding. And as many times as you avoid the situation, it doesn't make it easier. So if avoiding is maintaining the problem, what do you think we should do? And you go, not avoid. And then I go, yeah, that's what we call exposure. So let's take this hill. And then, you know, Marines and sailors and soldiers are all like, hoo-ah! And I was like, So at the VA, everyone was like, how do you get the
They don't leave us airmen out. You know, we like to, I said, don't leave us airmen out.
I know.
Alone, right?
I knew
we're
I was
there.
Gonna, like, go through everything.
We'll take the desk. Yeah. We'll take the desk.
And guardsmen and guards people, right? And thank you for your service. And so talking about going, which way do you want to go? I mean, I don't think we've got like a great way of pitching that part of it. And then following it and then acknowledging, hey, there may be moments as we're going through this, that there might be other stuff that we want to deal with. The other part is read the whole manual, right? So like, somebody's like, oh my gosh, they deal with alcohol. I was like, yeah, read the PE manual. There's a section on like when they drink alcohol, like they did the PE ALK study. I was there for it. Right. Like, I'm sorry. That was really a mean way of saying that, but like, you know, you don't have to do something totally different. You know, there are people who are thinking about how do we adjust instead of retrofitting something else and bringing it in, use the skills that we've got.
Right.
So if somebody has moral injury, how do you use in vivo or prominent shame? Or moral injury. How do we use the in vivo exposure to move that along? How do we use the imaginal exposure, right? But that's understanding how do these things work, right?
Right.
It's being a chef, not a line cook when we're doing this work, right? A chef understands how all of these things work together to really create something that is helpful, right? A line cook understands how to chop. And so that's really getting into what am I doing when I'm doing in vivo exposure, right?
Yeah.
There's no place in the PE manual, I think, where they describe if somebody has guilt and they say, I should have protected my guys and I should have known better. And I should have stopped them and I should have protected them better, you know. And the guilt's not going from the imaginals, right? Even though theoretically, you know, if you just let the imaginal do its work, the imaginal will actually wrecking ball a thought like that on its own.
Yeah.
If you shut up and you let the imaginal do the work, that thought doesn't hang out. But you're kind of going in and it's not working. There's nowhere in the PE manual, I think, where it goes, hey man, do me a favor. Is there any place where there's like a bunch of 18-year-olds near your house? And you're like, yeah, there's a college campus. I was like, I want you to do me a favor. I want you to do an in vivo exposure. Are you willing to do it? By that time, they're just like, yeah. And then, I mean, you talk to any service member, once they agree to do something, they're absolutely going to do it because, you know.
Yeah.
And so I just want you to hang out and observe 18-year-olds for an hour. And then I want you to go listen to your imaginal exposure. And then come back and tell me what's up, right? That's not in the PE manual, is it?
Right. No.
No.
Not that I've seen.
Right. And so then they come in and I go, hey, man, what did you notice? And you know what they say? They go, 18-year-olds are so stupid. And I go, what do you mean? I go, they're so stupid, right? And now if I do this to a Vietnam veteran, I'm like, yeah, but you know, 18-year-olds in 2025, they're different stupid. They're like, no, man, we had transistors. They're just a different stupid. Same stupid, different toys. And I'm like, huh. So what did you notice? And then and then the guy turns to me and goes, I was 18, Aaron.
Yeah.
I was 18 years old. What could I have known? And then he's just going, right. I did all of this stuff. We all survived. And I was 18, insert word, years old.
Yeah. That's such a great story.
So, but that's understanding what are the tools you have.
Right.
So the other piece that I think is so important to Footstomp, which again, I really appreciated in the presentation. We're going to put a link in the show notes to be able to watch that talk because it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. But it just because you're doing in vivo for PTSD doesn't mean it's not going to also have an impact on the depression or on the, you know, even the psychosis.
But like that's written in the manual. That's written in the manual. There are four categories of in vivo exposure, right? Things you avoid because it reminds you of the memories. Things that, that you don't do anymore because they feel dangerous because of the memories. Things that you avoid, I forget what the third one is. Things you no longer do that you previously enjoyed doing that do not cause you anxiety, but you have stopped doing since the trauma. That has always, forever, from the beginning of PE, been behavioral activation.
Right.
Absolutely.
Cheat sheet behavioral activation.
Yep.
I agree. But I think that's the most obvious one. But you know, even when you we don't have the case in front of us, but like I really also liked how you talked about it. If you are working with somebody who was having persecutory delusions and you're doing PE, like how does it sort of start to, not that you're treating both necessarily, the focus is still on the PTSD, but how does it influence what's going on with some of those symptoms?
Yeah. So I think when we look at it, we think about if we think of symptoms as a massive web, right? And every part of it, when you shake any piece of the web, how much of it is going to shake?
Yeah.
Right. And so, as I said at the beginning, I grew up treating PTSD, thinking about PTSD. So the first thing I will always think about is PTSD. The second thing I'll always think about, honestly, is negative symptoms of schizophrenia, right? Mm-hmm. So those are sort of the, you know, when I'm thinking about somebody with psychosis, because I think those are the two things that everybody ignores. Nobody thinks about PTSD. I mean, we write about it, we talk about it, we talk about caring about it, and then we never assess for it. And when we do, we assess for it badly. That's sort of like what's out in the world. And not you guys who are listening to it, anybody listening to this audio,
absolutely,
you guys are the best. But everybody out there, I mean, how many of you people listening to this right now scream into a pillow when somebody like misdiagnoses and, you know, misdoes it? Like that's like the bane of my existence. And so when we shake that web and we think about, if I treat this obstacle, what will be the knock-on effect, right? My worldview is nothing ever gets worse by removing PTSD from somebody's life.
Right.
I live in a world where I view all things as curable, because if I aim to cure something, and I know that this will be controversial, if I aim to cure something and I come up short, I'll probably be a lot better than if I aim to stabilize something and I come up short. So I aim for cure. And if we get short of it, then they're much better, right? But I never aim for stability, because I feel like that is not thinking about somebody recovering and living their life. Right. I don't want somebody to try to stabilize me. I don't want to live a stabilized life. I want to live a wonderful life, right? And so I think about, if I'm looking across the symptoms, I work, again, just like Jenna said, because I think it's so important. I think collaboratively, and I'll sit on my big board in my office and I'll go, hey, here's the things. And I'll draw lines between, if we take care of PTSD, if the memory stops haunting you. So I don't call it PTSD. I say, so if the memory stops popping in your mind and haunting you, Right. Yeah. What do you think is going to happen to the worry? Oh, well, I'll probably stop worrying as much, right? Because I'll stop having this threat popping into my mind, which makes me have to get ready, which will make me worry, which makes me think about more bad things, which makes me fearful of other people. Okay, cool. If the worry stopped in your mind, what do you think would happen to the PTSD? Well, it might chill out a little bit, but it probably isn't going to go away. Okay. Mm-hmm. What about if we, you know, what about if we kind of were able to sort of bring the alcohol use to heal? Well, the memories would probably still pop into my mind. Okay, cool. But they probably wouldn't go as hog wild at night, and I could probably sleep a little bit better. Okay, cool. So we could, that might be worth paying attention to, right? And so we can kind of look at it all together. I mean, if you want to be super formal, you could do a pro-con list. If anybody stayed on this podcast long enough, you've all kind of picked up. Formal is not like my middle name. It's Philip. So like all that to be said, you know, just sort of putting it all up there. Like we could work on voices. Voices might not impact stuff. But then sitting here going like, let's get the biggest bang for our buck.
Right.
But if we go back to the PE protocol, right? In the PE protocol, if somebody has more than one index trauma, which one do we usually, we will collaboratively decide together. But as therapists, we always go, hey man, not for nothing, but why don't we go after the worst one and then the other ones might shatter along. The person's like, that's freaky. We're like, okay, cool. You're the boss. You tell me, you give me my marching orders, but I'll do what you want. And then if they're like, let's do the second one, the less distressing one, we'll do it. But if they're like, yeah, I guess so. That sounds like a terrible idea. And I'm like, I know, let's do it anyway.
Right.
But like, right. So we always go after the harder one if they're up for it, because it'll have a knock-on effect. Mm-hmm. And so just as sort of a science follow-up, in the UK right now, they've been ahead of us on the interaction between psychosis and trauma / PTSD for a long time, but they're doing studies where they are prioritizing and privileging, meaning putting first, the treatment of PTSD for people with really severe schizophrenia and psychosis. Hmm. And so they start with trauma-focused treatments as long as the person agrees to doing it. Hmm. And a lot of these old, like long-term CBT for psychosis treaters are going like, I've always formulated trauma and PTSD. I've always treated it. I've never said, hey, nice to meet you. Let's do a trauma-focused treatment. They're like, I've never done that in my career. And they're like, it's wild to see all of the psychosis shatter or really loosen up and shatter by getting rid of the PTSD.
Fascinating.
That's amazing.
So to go back to pull together the big question, when we have a complex case, we write it all up on the board. We formulate each of the pieces together. And then we start deciding collaboratively, okay, where do we want to go first, right? We are going to be collaborative. And collaborative means everybody's got to say, right? Mm-hmm. The individual is the expert in their own life, why they're experiencing what they're experiencing, how they're experiencing it, what's leading them to continue doing the things that they're going to be doing, and where they want to be going in their life.
For sure.
And all we bring to it is we're experts in how many people have recovered. And just like when all of us were in like school, grad school, if you have a team project and one person doesn't lift their side, that person is the worst.
The worst.
So
I'm having painful memories.
But also if you have one person who takes over everything, that person's the worst. So as a therapist, as a psychologist, I don't take over everything. But on the other hand, I'm not going to sit back and go, hey, Hakuna Matata, you do what you do, right? And so when I'm talking with an individual, I'm going to say like, yeah, man, this PE thing sounds terrible. And it seems like if we did this, it would work, right? Mm-hmm. But this could work and this could work. What do you think? I don't tell them we're going to do it. I give them my opinion.
Right.
Yeah.
Right? Because I know how many people have recovered.
This is such a treat. One of the themes, or not one of the themes, we have one theme. The theme for this season, which we think is really important, is who's got your six? We're in season six. Who's got your six? Pretty clever. We know.
I love it. I think it's really cool. When I read that last night, I absolutely clapped my hands and was very excited about that.
So we want to hear from you. You know, as you've done this work, Certainly working with, I'm guessing, some pretty tough content
Right.
across the years, you know, passionate about it. But we all have, you know, it's a challenging work that you're doing. Who's had your six? Who's been there to kind of bolster you up and keep you moving forward and had your back? Because we think that's just a really important thing for our community to really think about. Who's got your six, why that's important. So tell us your story.
Sure. I think there's a lot of people. So obviously, as I'm saying this, if I don't mention one person, I think that's just to remind that.
We'll play the walk-off music.
I just have so many people who I've been fortunate to. I have an embarrassment of riches when it comes to friends. And particularly because I've got my fingers in so many different pies. Every pie, I've got somebody who has my six. And it is so important. And I teach all of my trainees that this is a team sport.
Yeah.
And I teach them that there is no place in society where people go at things alone. Nobody is successful. Even in the military, if you think about a sniper is never alone. There are two people in that job. So it is always a team sport. So for me, when I'm doing the hardest things, Elizabeth Hembry, who is my mentor, she still is my mentor and a dear friend.
Amazing.
She has this very bizarre spidey sense. And when I was ever doing the hardest imaginable exposures, I would be leaving my private practice and I'd be walking and somehow I would get a phone call from her. And she would be like, "Hey, how's it going? Hey, Aaron, how'd it go tonight?" Right. And then we would talk about it. Here now in my current work, I've got colleagues like Julia Sheffield, who is a young psychosis researcher. I've got people like Louise Isham and Felicity Waite and Amy Hardy in the UK. As I do these really difficult cases, in my life, I've been really lucky as I was doing these really difficult cases when he was alive. I had Aaron Beck, who, so Tim, he loved hearing about these cases. And when I was really stressed, there were times where he would sit me down. And so that's my professional six. And I think it's really important for us to recognize that as we go through this world, we can talk about that there's a personal toll that this work can have on us. And it can.
For sure.
I think if we do a good job, there was some research a while back that when we engage in evidence-based treatments that we're less likely to have these other vicarious traumatization.
It's the most protective against provider burnout.
Yeah. If you do have that study, I would love for you to send that to me because I can never find it.
I know. I will look for it. Yes.
And, you know, life isn't for the faint of heart. And so I've shared very openly. I'm sharing more and more openly about the fact that probably for the last 2 or 3 years on and off, I've really struggled with depression.
Yeah.
And it's been really hard because I've experienced two times in my life, some pretty significant loss. And in those times, I can only speak about what it's like to be a man. So I'm not going to speak what it's to be a woman, but men are really stupid. We're really stupid. I can only speak about that.
I can confirm.
And so for so many times I talked about being tired, just don't have the energy. I'm not really up for it. Right. Never that I was depressed. Right.
Right.
You know, I'm not really into my work right now, but like all of a sudden I had played a video game for like a day straight. And that was just because I really wanted to get to the next level. I'm a doctor, guys. Like I know what depression is. Right.
Right.
And, as I was going through these losses, one of the things I know is that shame grows in the darkness. And we, as those who go out and we leave the path of lightness and healing to help others find their way back from the path, are so okay with not allowing other people to know. And shame can grow on us in that darkness. And so as I was dealing with these losses, I immediately talked to the people who had my six. And those were people who really saved me. And those were Elizabeth Hembry and my division director, Blythe Corbett, and my chair, Stefan Heckers, and Julia Sheffield, and many, many more people out there in the world. And people who didn't know that they were helping me, right? Who just were good friends and good people out there. And obviously, I've got a fantastic family. I've got a wonderful wife. I've got a fantastic son. I've got Bonnie, who is like the best dog in the world. We got a tortoise, which you would think wouldn't be that wonderful, but Cosmo's really fantastic. I've got a wonderful mother-in-law. I've got all of these wonderful people. And it's easy as a psychologist who has gone out and done all of this work to go, I should be okay to be fine. And in sharing my story, I've seen how many of us can be hurt, but we ignore it because we go to our sessions. And so I try to share it so that my trainees know that it's okay to not be okay and to share it with your friends. But the people who have my six are people on my level, right?
Right.
But to know that that's okay and to share that.
Yeah.
And I'm doing much better. There are days where I feel like depression is like a bad knee. There's some days you stand up and you're like, whoa, the knee's not working. But there are a lot more days where things are really exciting and really good.
So appreciate
hashtag
that.
Relatable, Aaron. That's all I can say. You know, I think Kevin and I can high five you and agree. And I appreciate you saying that. I appreciate you being willing to share that on the podcast because it is the most important message.
Yeah.
And
if really we don't share it, then nobody else is going to share it.
Exactly.
Right?
Agreed.
So.
Yeah. Well, so what we always do, we're kind of, I would say we're coming up on the end of our time. I think that went away a long time ago.
Oh, shoot.
Which is fine. No, it's great.
This is like this a classic Aaron experience, by the way. Like,
this has been such a great conversation, though. And
I don't want it to end.
Me either. But I'm thinking as we're kind of wrapping up here, you know, normally we also leave our listeners with a couple of things that they can do. We call it actionable intel. What are some things people can take away from listening to this episode, start applying right away, that can have a positive impact on the work that they do? Do you have a couple of thoughts for us about actionable intel?
Resources, yeah.
Yeah, resources too.
Incoming actionable intel.
Yeah, get a bunch of blank paper or a dry erase board or a PowerPoint. And when you sit there, be compassionate with yourself and say, yeah, these are complex cases, and go, I don't know what's going on. And then get that blank sheet of paper out and write every part of the complexity on the paper. And then with that individual, start figuring out the complexities. What you may start realizing is as you write all the complexity and get it out of your brain and onto the paper, they might start to link together, right? So like worry and a couple other things, they may all sort of hang out together over on the right-hand side. And then all of a sudden sort of like avoidance and depression and sort of like irritability. And, oh, that's actually all the PTSD stuff. So that's all chilling out over there. And you might start seeing it lumping together. But develop a formulation and then figure out how are they all creating this sort of misery formula inside this individual trying to serve? And so that would be sort of action one. And so it's creating this perpetual motion machine thing that's going on, right? Actionable intel number two is then figure out what is the tool that will move that piece, right? Mm-hmm. The way you eat a whale is one bite at a time, whether it's a real whale or a tofu whale, vegan food is fine, right? Is do it. You may also find, oh man, I don't have I don't have a fork and knife for this specific thing. And then you can go out and find it out because you'll start looking at where your holes in learning, right? You might not have a good worry intervention. You can go get it. But if you're listening to this podcast, right, and you hang out with Kevin and Jenna and the whole crew there at CDP, you probably have a ton of skills, right? And so, what did you say?
I said, we hope.
Oh, I hope so. I know so, right? I know this. And so figure out which of those, if you wiggle the most, is going to work. And then propose that with your individual. Early on, if you do this a little, like before the person comes in, you'll feel a little bit more comfortable. Eventually, this will be sort of the way you talk with the individuals that you serve, right? And so once you propose it, lock into the intervention. Say, let's do this for 8 weeks and then see where are we going to go next? 8, 10, you know, whatever the intervention is. Some interventions, some of the skills in some of those interventions, you might retrofit for somebody who doesn't fit a specific intervention. There are people who their presentation does not fit a specific intervention. Those are probably a little bit more of the exception. They're not always the rule, right? I think what we think is those are all the rule, and then these randos are the exception. And so try kind of doing that piece of it.
Sounds great. And then too, for resources, I think you'd mentioned, right, you've got a book coming out.
I do, right? So if people are interested in getting a little bit more into CBT for psychosis, and particularly recovery-oriented cognitive therapy, I just finished a book called Living Well with Psychosis. It's part of a new series from the Guilford series called Living Well. They currently have Living Well with Bipolar Disorder, Living Well with OCD, and mine is Living Well with Psychosis. It's written directly to individuals with psychosis. It's also really helpful for practitioners because you could pick it up and think like, okay, how would you talk with people about it? And things like that. If you were like, wow, this guy's a lot to read, the book's out, a lot to listen to. The book is a lot like listening to me talk, or at least the people who have read it, in that part. So it's for pre-order now, and it's coming out.
Thank you so much. We're going to include all of those resources and links and such in the show notes too. So you don't have to try to write it down real fast. Go check out the show notes and find the links there. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
It was worth the wait. It was worth the wait, Aaron.
Yeah. We'll have to do this again sometime.
Yeah. Yeah.
I agree. We can definitely have a follow-on episode. And we are, as Kevin said, we're really grateful for your time. I'm really grateful personally for your passion and commitment and enthusiasm for not just the population that are near and dear to our heart, but you know, people out there who have benefited from that passion. So thank you for all you do. We're so glad we got to connect. And for our listeners out there, we look forward to you joining us in our next episode. So be well. And as always, stay curious.
And mind your EVPs. Remember, we love hearing from our listeners. So leave us a message on SpeakPipe or send us an email. Both can be found in our show notes. Our theme music is Failed Attempts by Nitro, and our administrative assistant is Bree Mercer.
Thanks for listening to Practical for Your Practice.
If you like what you're hearing, please feel free to follow us, rate this episode, and share it with others.
Until next time.